Looks good.
Okay, welcome everybody. It's Amanda Blake from Embright, and I'm here with Anne Betts from Be Above Leadership, and we're having a conversation about the neuroscience of learning. And so excited to be with all of you all today. So, Anne, anything you want to say in terms of words of introduction, how we came to this conversation, what we're wanting to offer you all today?
Yeah, let's see. So Mandy and I got put together on a panel a couple of years ago and just had a great time. And I think it's because Mandy just comes from what I would call a very integrated place of being open and curious about learning and really non-protective. And I love to be with people like that. And what we were finding is we just wanted to talk and talk and talk to each other. And we've had a number of conversations that have been really, really enjoyable. Both sort of there's a place where, you know, if you think about sort of a little mini Venn diagram, there's a huge place where she and I meet with understanding of neuroscience. And that's what I do is with my business partner, Ursula, teach neuroscience and consciousness to coaches largely. So the huge area of overlap. Some areas where she's doing stuff that is new to me and really cool, and then some areas where I'm doing stuff that may be new to her. So I think that's kind of the three things we want to talk about today is, you know, what do we underline for each other and highlight for each other? And it's just a big yes. What are you doing? What am I doing? What do we each know so we can bring more awareness to everybody?
Yeah, hear. I would second all of that. And I think what we're hoping to be able to offer you all today, what we're hoping to be able to share, it are some thoughts on integration and the neuroscience of integration. Like, what does it really mean to be deeply integrated as a human being? And Anne has a take on that, and I have a take on that, and we're going to talk a little bit about why we believe that's so important. And those of you who have studied with us, maybe with me in my Body Equals Brain course or in Anne with the courses she teaches, which I don't even know what they're called, but we'll talk more about that later. Some of these may be familiar concepts, and you'll get to hear like a little bit of a different take on something that maybe you've been exposed to in other ways. And then we kind of want to diverge from that meeting point of integration and look at, as Anne said, some of the things that we have to share with each other and teach each other, because we've been sort of pursuing related and somewhat parallel, but like wiggly parallel paths. So like places where we intersect and places where we've really created some interesting things in the divergence. So let's start with this question of integration. Anne, do you want to talk a little bit?
I was going to ask you. Either one, but that's it. So let me ask you. So what does integration mean to you, and why is it important? Why is it a critical thing for human beings?
So when I talk about integration, I often talk about it with an ecological metaphor, because that tends to be really easy for people to understand. And also because I have a background in ecology, among other things. And so, I look at it like if you were to plant acres and acres and acres of corn and a pest comes along, that pest has free range at all of that corn, and those hundreds of acres can, you know, get immediately chewed up. If you plant corn and beans and tomatoes and potatoes and this and that and this and that, then you may have an acre of corn that's really vulnerable to those pests. But over here, this acre of corn that's at a distance from the original acre is safer. Because those pests don't really know that, you know, there's other great food for them nearby, right? If they're corn specific pests. So,
I don't want to interrupt you, but I'm loving this metaphor, because I'm also thinking about, and I'm not an ecologist, but I'm thinking about things that put nitrogen into the soil, things that take nitrogen out of the soil, and the way that we are ecologically balanced. That feels really rich in terms of that metaphor as well.
Well, one of the things that you'll see is like in a forest ecosystem or an ocean ecosystem, or those ecosystems get healthier as they get more diverse. And then there's more connections between the diversity of species. So more symbiotic links, more mushrooms eating dying trees, you know, more birds scattering seeds of the trees so the trees can grow. So all of those, it's like the more diversity and the more relatedness, the more integrated a living system is. Yeah. And once a living, that integration is, so to answer your question in my way, like, why is this so important? Across living systems, integration is both a sign of and also a characteristic of health, of robust health. And what that looks like in human beings and what that looks like in when we're talking about neuroscience and particularly neuroscience and embodiment is it looks like accessing more of the parts of our intelligence. So we're not just accessing our linguistic, intellectual, rational part of our intelligence, but we're also accessing our embodied intelligence, our felt sense intelligence, the intelligence of the way we stand or breathe or move. And that all of that is not just differentiated, like we can see the different parts and pieces and observe those in action, but they're also related, they're linked together. And so that's how I talk about integration and its value and why it's so important, right? So important to the health of any living system.
Oh, I love it. And I think this is just this great example of this huge overlap here, even to the words. And one of my favorite quotes comes from the French theologian, and I will butcher his name because I don't speak French, but Teilhard de Chardin. And he said, everything that rises must converge. And when there's a convergence, it doesn't mean complete agreement, but a convergence of ideas, then I know that we're in the realm of truth. And, or I believe we're in the realm of truth. And so when I think about integration, I use Dr. Dan Siegel's definition, which is he was one of my early teachers, the linkage of differentiated parts. So it's exactly what you're saying. We have differentiation. We know, so if I think about it in a human being, I have awareness of the parts. And I'll talk in just a minute a little bit what we think some of the critical parts are. So I have awareness of the parts, but I also have an ability to bring them together. So I think about, for example, in our programs, we're looking at a better understanding of the right hemisphere and left hemisphere of the brain. Pulling away from this idea that there are left hemisphere people and right hemisphere people, what we now know and have seen is more that there are disintegrated people and increasingly integrated people who are more able to have dual firing contextually. So in a particular situation, they're able to both be able to, the right brain takes in the whole and is looking at the bigger picture, relationships, things like that, whereas the left hemisphere is very specific, concrete, sequential, and looking at the details. The more you get dual firing, actually, the more you get things like creativity, logic, and intuition. Which we have actually said logic is left hemisphere, creativity is right, intuition's right. We know the research doesn't bear that out. They are functions of high integration. And what the research says, for example, research on creativity says when you've got somebody who passes high marks in a creativity test, you put them in a brain scanner, you've got more firing on both sides. So we link it to effectiveness. And we have a model at Be Above, those of you familiar with our stuff, we have a model of effectiveness. And the main critical factor we've seen is how integrated is the brain itself, the brain with the body, how connected is it? We'll talk a little more about that. How connected is this being with what is beyond? How integrated are we with each other? What's our relationship to time? All of these things seem to relate to higher levels of effectiveness. So, and health.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I just love the way you're putting that. I think what we find is, in general, as living systems get healthier, they get more effective. Mm-hmm. So we can see that in organizations, for example, where people have clear roles and strong relationships with each other, those organizations become more effective at whatever their end aim is, whether it's a corporation or a government or a, mm-hmm. you know, NGO, or it doesn't matter the form of the organization, but the more the people have their individual parts to play and are connected to each yes. other, the more effective they get. And the same thing is true in the human organism, which is also a living system. As we get more integrated, we get healthier, and we get more effective. And one of the things that Anne and I were talking about before we got on the call with you all was this idea of or phenomenon, I guess, that we've both seen in our own lives and that we've seen with the people that we work with, that the more integrated you get, the more you're able to kind of stand back and maybe take a broader perspective mm-hmm. on the slings and arrows of life. And because of that, deal with those slings and arrows better, right?
Yeah, let me show something about this. And I don't know, I actually don't know because I've never asked you if you use this in your work. You probably do. But we love the Dan Siegel model of the brain. Do you guys use that? So
I don't really use it, but yeah, I know what you're talking about. So please share it.
Yeah, it's a good little... it's a good little technique, and it is a place where I think about one of the critical areas of integration, which Dan would call vertical integration. So here's what Dan Siegel, who's a wonderful, he's a psychiatrist and also researcher and writes a lot about the brain and a brilliant man, one of the great minds of our time. So he said, this is your brain. So if you put everybody put your hand up, because it's great to do it. Put your thumb in the middle, close your fingers over it. And this is a fairly good model of your brain. So you can put your hands down and now you've got it. This right here would be your brain stem. And the brain stem is like here, it's where it's connecting to the body. Brain stem is sort of the early brain, the first to evolve. What it's monitoring is things like breathing, temperature, heart rate, things that are automatic largely. And it's participating in the fight, flight, freeze response. Go up in here where your thumb is, and this is your limbic system and your amygdala. And that's buried deep within the brain, and one of its jobs is to scan the world for threats. Are you a friend or a foe? Do I need to tell this part of the brain to run, fight, freeze, play dead, etc.? If you curl your fingers over, what we've got here is the neocortex, and then right here, the prefrontal cortex. So prefrontal cortex, highest brain, right here in your head, it's really the executive director or the seat of executive functioning of the brain. And Manny, I don't know if there's other ways you like to talk about it, but it's, you know, long-term planning, abstract thinking. When we think we're thinking, I think a lot of it is prefrontal function.
That's how I talk about it, Anne, is prefrontal is a lot of our experience of thinking. While it absolutely involves our whole body, and we can talk about this, when we go, well, let me think about that for a minute. Look what happens to my face, right? It's all happening like right in here. Yes. And if you notice your own sensations, when you go, I'm going to plan this vacation that we're taking, and I think we're going to go here, and then we're going to go here, and you'll feel sensation here. There's a lot firing. There's a lot happening here.
Right. And in fact, as I am describing this, I am aware of feeling it right here. And if I have to spend too much time here, I start feeling like, you know, everything's sort of clogged up.
Yep.
That's the prefrontal cortex. And this is a great, you can teach this. We have a wonderful friend, his name is Shay Sun, and he teaches middle school in Riverside, California. He's taught all of his middle schoolers when they come in to flash him a signal so he knows, are you online? Like your prefrontal cortex is good, it's functioning, or are you stressed and upset? Because he's aware as a teacher, you can't teach to this. This part of the brain is interested in survival. This part of the brain is interested in health and thriving and can, you know, manage things. So when we think about integration, this is only one aspect, but a very critical one. What we want is to have this part of the brain able to connect to this part of the brain. And I think of that, you know, you say sort of managing the slings and arrows. I think of that as being in observer mind and watching oh God, I'm upset by this. What's going on? What's my body telling me? Do I really want to send that email right now, or should I wait until I calm down? Am I going to say, because whatever we do from here tends to create more damage in the world, damage to our own system. We're running adrenaline and cortisol through our bodies, which are not healthy in a long-term way, and also damage to our relationships. So being integrated to me means, it doesn't mean you never get upset, you never get mad, you never get scared, of course you do, but it means that you get an increasing ability to be present to this.
Yeah, let me comment on that, because that's a place where I agree and also diverge. And the place where I diverge is the spot where you said, you know, if you're running from here, then, you know, you're going to make decisions that you regret. That's not what you said. But, you know, this contains risk if you're running exclusively from here. I would strongly, strongly agree that the more integrated you are, the more effective you're going to be. And what I would add to that is there's an integration from here all the way down through the brainstem, through your spine, and into out into your fingers and toes. So one of the things that we know about the neurobiology of your body is that all the time your physical or your organs, your viscera, your fascia, which is an organ that surrounds every muscle and bone and tissue in your body and allows your organs to slide by each other. All of these organs are constantly sending messages to the brain.
Right.
And it state that for really, really, really good biologically adaptive reasons, all of that pretty much stays below our conscious awareness unless you bang your shin on the table or you get that, you know, really stressful phone call that has your heart beating in your chest in a way that you can feel it, right? But most of the time, those sensations that are happening below the neck aren't in our awareness unless they're bothering us in some way. But what happens is those sensations get processed in here.
Right. Yep.
Right. And so what happens is if we're not consciously aware of what those sensations are, we will react out of this part of our brain, out of this limbic or emotional part of our brain, or even sort of the safety part of our brain. We will react. We will have, that is the genesis of a knee-jerk reaction, right? And we'll have some reactive tendency that we'll later regret and not necessarily be so proud of. But again, coming back to integration, when you can be more consciously aware of the sensations in your body, all of which are being parsed here in sort of the middle, the very central part of your brain, the more consciously aware you can be of those sensations, the more integrated you are here, the more integrated you are here, the more choice you have about how you respond. So you don't necessarily, react in a knee-jerk way, but you do take a breath and go, do I want to send that email right now? Do I want to respond in the way I feel this impulse to respond? So, Anne, I see you nodding your head. I don't know if it's right to call this so much a divergence.
I don't think it's at all. I know. Right.
But maybe just adding to what you're saying.
Yeah. You're adding the, you know, one of our favorite quotes is the brain is a William Allman said this, he's a physicist, he said the brain is a monstrous, beautiful mess.
Yeah.
It is so complex. And what I love is that you brought in, yeah, there's complexity here. It's hugely complex. It's not enough to say, oh, this is bad. This is giving us a ton of information. It's giving us a ton of our intuition. It's really what you say is the more we literally have neural fibers that go here, the more choice we have. Because sometimes what you need is your body. I mean, oh my God, this has happened to all of us and our clients. If you're a coach or a therapist, our bodies are telling us things that sometimes we don't listen to our own detriment. And that's part of this processing. It's just a huge, you know, and this is where I think one of the reasons that we just love each other is that we both agree the brain is not this little stuff in the head. The brain is everywhere. It is all throughout us. And some of the latest research is even saying, you know, we have neurons all throughout our body, and they are thinking. They're not just sending information and the brain is the only thing that knows what's going on. Oh, you're so wise, little gray matter. It's more that they're participating in thought. They're participating in calculation. And this part is a part of it. It's a critical part. It runs a lot. But the whole thing down to our fingertips. And Mandy, I don't know if we've talked about this. I'm sure you've seen the research where, I'm going to say it came out of University of Finland, where, and I don't know how they did the research, so forgive me, I can't totally explain the research protocol. But basically what they found is that the fingers, neurons in the skin, in the fingertips, were sending complete calculations of the geometry of an object to the brain. So the way we've always thought about it is, well, the fingers will give us data points, and then the brain, because it is so smart and in charge of everything, then figures it all out. And we're saying it may not be that way. Completed calculations. That's fascinating to me, and I think this is a whole area where we don't even know to the degree that our bodies are thinking.
Yeah, it's what you're reminding me of, and this is going a little far afield of what we said we're going to talk about, but you're reminding me of some studies that have been done on people who, sensory deprivation studies, right? Yeah. So sometimes on people who are blind from birth, sometimes on people who are hearing impaired, and sometimes on people who, for example, are sighted, mm-hmm. but are blinded, like with a blindfold for 24/7 for a week kind of thing. And what is found is not only are, particularly for sighted people who are blindfolded for a period of time, their brain starts to rewire mm-hmm. their hearing, literally their the neurons that physically hear yeah. start to rewire into the visual centers.
Yeah.
So that there starts to be a visual map of what we hear. And it's similar but different from what you're saying, where you know research that shows that complete calculations from our sensory system are being sent to what we think of as our apparatus of understanding. Right. Mm-hmm. But the reality is there is understanding in your fingertips. Right. There is understanding in your listening very, very, very directly.
You know, Mandy, one of the things that has been really curious to me, I don't think the studies have been done, but I think about as a coach, and I've worked with human beings as an executive coach for about 16 years now. And I remember, and I've trained coaches as you do as well. And, you know, when I was training beginning coaches, they're saying, how can you do this over the phone? You're missing so much information. The longer I became a coach, the less that mattered at all, because I was hearing so much. And it's interesting that you're saying it's getting wired into the visual field. And I wonder, you know, I'm not going blindfolded 24/7, but I'm actually wondering, by spending that much amount of time trying to understand people's emotions and motivations, what are they really saying? What's going on? I wonder if some of us as coaches get a little bit of that same rewiring, and that's what makes us more and more effective over time at really hearing things that newer coaches struggle to hear. And we just think, well, that was obvious. How could you not hear that? Boy, you're on the billboard.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I would imagine that's absolutely true, that there's a rewiring that takes place from, I know for myself, I can say, you know, with practice, there has been a very clear rewiring of my ability to feel and experience and know and be aware of sensation right now while I'm talking to you.
Yeah.
Which, you know, even a decade ago in my life would never have happened. Right. Yeah. But now for me, it's automatic. It's second nature. And it brings me to one of the things that I think is really important for us to understand when we're talking about how the brain learns and how the body learns, is while there are absolutely, threshold moments, right? Like you have an experience which you cannot go back from. And this is easiest to see in trauma situations where you can have one experience and it gets completely wired into your whole neurobiology very, very quickly. So that,
call that the hot stove effect. It's protective. Right. Like, don't ever do that again, and you will never forget it. And it, part of it is the impact of adrenaline on learning. But
precisely. And so we can absolutely wire things in very quickly, but mostly the way the embodied brain learns is through practice, through repetition and immersion. It can't just be writing words on a chalkboard. I will listen better as a coach. It actually needs to be you sitting, listening differently, right? Over and over and over and over again, until physiologically you actually change inside in ways that make that listening very automatic.
You know, what I noticed when I was, when I was teaching coaching, I taught in our certification program, and we would do mid-program reviews, which was about halfway through. And what I would notice is that, not individually, but if I looked at a sort of a statistical analysis, it seemed to me that people who had, we required 100 hours by the end of the program, and people that at the midpoint had 50 hours were getting really good scores. And people would come in and they'd say, I'm not getting very good scores from my supervisors, they're rating me low. And I would look at the hours, and most of the time, 75% of the time, there was a correlation there. They were at 20 hours. And I would say, here's all you need to do. You need to practice and get your hours in and listen to what your supervisors are telling you, because you can also, through neuroplasticity, reinforce bad habits, which is why it's great to have a coach and get feedback. And, you know, if you're consistently doing the wrong thing with clients, you can wire that in. But it was really, I didn't mean to make it into a formula, but I would say, like, really, like, don't worry. All you need to do is keep practicing here. And I would tend to see a bump as their hours went up.
That's really interesting, and not a surprise to me, but kind of just fascinating to me to hear that you saw that pattern. It's certainly affirming. Listen, I want to shift us a little bit, because I know we promised people that we would give them some actionable things, and we were excited about some of the actionable things we wanted to share. So I'm not sure how to make that transition, but maybe that gives you some ideas.
That's great. I'm glad you want to make that transition, because I also want to give time for questions. So do this maybe eight or 10 more minutes. You know, I think this comes to, and tell me if this is taking us down a rabbit hole, but one of the things that we both share this is what you do. This is what I learned as I came more into neuroscience. I realized that if I wasn't using the body, I wasn't using the whole brain. And that there's so many people in coaching and therapy that have that see the body maybe as an optional thing, or that occasionally they might ask their client, well, where do you feel that in your body? And then the client says, I don't feel anything, and they give up.
No, I like what you said earlier to me, which is the client looks at you like you have three heads.
Yes, exactly. I actually had a client say to me one time, he was a coach, he said, oh, I forgot to tell you, I should have designed with you. Questions like that don't work for me. And I said, oh, well, I forgot to tell you that because of neuroscience, I'm going to tell you why you need to answer that question. I helped him understand the mechanism, because that was all he needed, was to understand the mechanism by which his body was trying to give him information. And maybe this is a place to go for some of our clients who are just thinking that the body was invented to carry this around. They need to know how to engage in it. And if you just try to beat them with it, they won't necessarily, but if you can give them some rationale. So I'm curious, what do you say? If you have a client who says to you, Mandy, well, those kind of questions don't work for me. What would you say?
You know what? These days, what I would say is, these days, I usually head all that off at the pass.
You design around it.
You know, I can see it coming a million miles away. I think it's really important to be able to, you know, what you are pointing to there is the need to be able to help, what I describe it as, help the intellectual self relax so that, you know, like kind of, sometimes I think I've heard you say, like, throw the intellect a bone, right? Like help the intellectual self relax a little bit and trust that even though this might be outside your realm of experience or outside the, you know, your comfort zone or just unfamiliar, that there's actually, there's a reason why we're doing this. This isn't just a weird woo-woo thing to do. And so one of the things that I will often talk about is evolutionary biology, naturally, right? Because what else are you going to talk about in your coaching session? So what I talk about, so if we go back to this hand model of the brain, right? What I talk about is, so evolutionarily, the very first nervous system on the scene in a single-celled organism was just like the cell itself. But as cells started to kind of glom together and become multi-celled organisms, there needed to be something to kind of control the whole system. And I like to point to the earthworm because it's really easy for people to understand. The way the earthworm brain evolved, whatever, you know, millions of years ago, is it involved like little beads down a string, right? And so there are these little clusters of neurons, by the way, not too different from what happens in your spinal cord, which is where your spinal cord really evolved from. And and those clusters of nerve cells are all about sensing the environment that the worm is in, and then having the worm be able to move in response to that. Right. And as nature went along and developed more creatures and just being able to sense the environment and move kind of slowly away from a looming dinosaur foot wasn't quite enough to stay out of danger. Right.
And tools and things like that. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And so there became this cluster of nerve cells that concentrated in one area. And that's what evolved into the brainstem. And the brainstem evolved around an evolutionary pressure of taking care of safety. We need to like be able to move out of the way of this looming dinosaur foot. And so that's why, you know, you were saying earlier, and the brainstem will be really involved in your fight flight response. And that's part of the reason why. So the evolutionary pressure there was safety. And then mammals came on the scene. The evolutionary pressure there was, oh, we're now giving live birth and offspring and caregivers need to be able to communicate with each other. So the emotional brain, the limbic system came on the scene. This evolved in response to mammalian live birth. And it's really about connection and communication.
And
right?
Care for vulnerable beings.
Right.
Yeah,
very much. And then the newer part of the brain, what biologists know about the newer part of the brain is that there's more neural density in this newer part of the brain. And now lots of species have this newer part of the brain, even if they're not like highly social species. But what biologists know is this newer part of the brain, the neocortex, has more neural density when for animals that are in more complex social groups. So it's, for example, dogs have more neural density in their neocortex than do cats, right? They're much more social creatures. And the thinking is that, oh, this was created, that's not quite right, but you know, it evolved in response to the complexities of living in a social group where we need to navigate amongst other, you know, other beings. And so this question of sort of evolutionary biology, I don't usually talk about it at this level of depth with clients, but what I'll say is, you know, sort of briefly, here are the ways in which your brain evolved to be your social and emotional sense organ, right? It evolved around taking care of safety and connection and your place in the social group. Right? And because it evolved that way, and because we know it's, of course, it does not stop at your ears, right? It goes all the way down through your spinal cord and it's tied to movement and sensation and all the way out to your fingers and toes. Your body is your social and emotional sense organ. Mm-hmm. And so I'll very often, you know, share with clients right up front this kind of view, like, hey, look, your body is actually there's a whole like millions and millions of years of evolutionary history here that have created your body to be this very sensitive instrument that tell you a lot about your relational life and your emotional life. And if you look at what's going on, like if I'm working with a business leader and I go, you look at what's going on in your business and what challenges you're having, most of the time, it will be either an emotional reaction to a situation that's difficult to you or something to do with a relationship you're in. 90%+ of the time, it's one of those two things.
And your whole body is monitoring that and is taking in information and processing. And I think this also leads, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I'm done, speak.
I love that, I think that's so good. Because I think about when we think about human relationships and we have some work that we do. We call it the human intuition system, but I sometimes call it the human relationship system because it's really all the ways that we're taking in information from each other, which are constant. We're taking information in through the way that we're mirroring in our own brain what's happening over there. We're taking in critical information through smell. I will have a stress reaction if I can smell that you're having a stress reaction. And again, as you said earlier, this is below conscious processing. I'm not aware, I don't think you smell bad. I'm just picking up on there's heightened adrenaline and cortisol, and then my body mimics that. So we are exquisitely attuned to each other, not through here. In fact, this is probably one of the worst places if you just limit it to here. The body is exquisitely tuned and is telling us so much. So, you know, sometimes what I say to my clients who don't want to go there is I say, well, that's just fine if you only want to use half your brain.
Yeah. It's much simpler than my method, but it's true. I mean, I say that all the time, right? I say, look, this is, you know, you are leaving a huge portion of your intelligence on the table.
Exactly. And probably, honestly, I don't know what percentage, and I don't like those studies. I don't like that research. I don't accurate. We use way more than 10% of our brain. We use our brain. It's not true that we only use 10% of our capacity. That's nonsense. However, when I think about everything that the body is processing and the neurons in my gut and the neurons in my heart and the neurons places I don't even know, and the way my nervous system is interacting and all of that and the way I'm interacting to other people, it could be that it's 90% is what's being really managed or mitigated by my body. It could be as much as that. And so if you're not clued into that, or what's happened is that you have developed, been rewarded, or been punished so that you have no neck down sensation, which I've had clients like that. You know, and you ask questions like, where do you feel it in your body? And the reason they look at you like you have three heads could be because they're not feeling anything in their body. Yeah. This is a disconnect. There's no neural wiring that is connecting there, often because of trauma. At worst because of trauma, at best because they've never had any reward or any language around that. And so they're missing life. They're missing their own life. They're missing their own wisdom. They're missing what their soul is trying to tell them, I think.
Yeah, hear, hear.
Yeah. So how do we help someone? The last question, then maybe we should go to Q&A. So if we've got a client that can't be aware of what's going on, is not able to use that part of their brain, how do we help them, Mandy? What would you do?
Well, the number one thing, and I would also say this is really important for each of us as coaches, because we cannot help someone here if we don't, we can only help someone up to the limits of our own capacity is what I would say. And so my shorthand is feel more of your sensations, right? And there are lots of ways that you can do that. And one of the really big ways that I advocate for is for clients to get body work. Because I think it's incredibly helpful for helping them feel themselves more. But there are also lots of things that you can do apart from having someone get body work. So for example, three things that you can do to help someone feel themselves more right now.
Okay.
You can do this with me, okay? Just rub your skin, right? On one arm, rub your skin. And then let that go and notice where you rubbed your skin and how it's different from the other arm.
Yeah. Or right, even that, a hand that was doing the rubbing. Is
it will wake up sensation to kind of briskly rub your skin. Another thing that will wake up sensation is to do some kind of stretch. So same thing, you can stretch, you know, stretch your hand and your arm in some way. And just
stretch, come on, you're not stretching. Let's see. Right.
See you. And definitely breathe as you stretch, because the more you're getting more oxygen into these right. cells, and that will wake up sensation. So rub your skin, stretch, or do something. We're not going to do this now in for the sake of time, but do something to get your heart rate up. So mm-hmm. even just asking your client to stand up and do 10 jumping jacks, you know, and then sit down. And now let's talk about this again and see if you can feel more of your sensations.
I really love this. It's so practical. And what it's doing, back to what we were talking about before, is for clients like that, they need to create the neural patterning around it. And it's giving them baby steps to do that. The other thing I'm just going to add before we go to Q&A is, I also think using metaphor can be a little bit of a trick to the brain. It's like, you may not be able to tell me directly how you feel. That may be threatening. There may even be trauma. But if I ask you, well, if this were a, you know, an animal, or if it were a plant, and I often find with clients that are not as comfortable with metaphor, giving them categories. Metaphor is very much a right brain function. Right brain is where we're more aware of body sensations. The right brain is more receptive to the information that's coming in because it is cued to everything new and novel. The left brain is more cued to what we already know. So metaphor, asking them for if it's an animal, if it's a plant, if it's a car, things like that will help people who are a little more concrete, sequential, left brain get over to the right. And then, well, how does that animal feel? It's like going in through the back door. And what I find is people can often do that, and that can start creating some of these neural connections too.
Yeah, beautiful. I love it. Well, so shall we go to questions?
Yeah, we should. We've been yakking away.
I know. Anne and I were worried about this call because we were like, are we going to be able to stop?
We clearly
really just want to hear from you guys.
We need to do it every month. Why don't you ask questions? I'll see if there's anything in the chat.
Okay, you take a look at chat, and then folks, if you go to manage participants again, and you mouse over that window to the lower right hand corner where it says more, you can raise your hand. So choose to raise your hand if you have a question, and I will see you, and I will come around to you.
And let me just say, Laura Negro. I'm sorry if I pronounced that wrong. She just has a beautiful thing that she wrote in. I also find helpful how Rick Hansen, he wrote The Buddha's Brain. He's a lovely man. Explains how the brain areas map to our three great hardwired core needs. This is great, Laura. Safety, brainstem, satisfaction, this subcortex mammalian brain, and connection, as Mandy said, our social and emotional sense organ here. So
yeah.
I think that was great. And I don't think there was anything else in the chat that other than people saying they had to go. So. Yeah.
Terrific. Okay, thanks for checking chat. I don't see anyone raising their hands. So what I'd love to do is, I'm so glad that we were crystal clear and nobody has a single question. That's amazing.
There's just so much they don't know what to ask. Oh, here's a chat. Brian is asking, what are some baby steps for the viscera organs instead of just external or fascia? Let me answer that quickly, and then I think Mandy probably has more. The baby steps for me, and this is a practice that I took on years ago for the organs, is what I like to check in, it's my form of meditation. So, and it's really helped me be a very not anxious person coming from a very anxious family and a lot of history of that. So what I do is I just throughout the day have a habit, and I think it's just automatic at this point, but I've been doing it for 15 years, of checking in with my core. Constantly checking in with my core to the point that I don't have to ask myself now, but in the early days, I would think, I'm driving to a meeting, I'm nervous about this, hold on, where do I feel it? And I don't know that I can always get out to my liver, I'm not that sophisticated, But what I can do is get these, you know, sort of like, is it lower stomach, upper stomach, heart, lungs, throat, face? That's going to give you a lot of information, because what you're tracing there is something called the vagus nerve. And that's the main nerve that is sending sensations from the organ up to the brain. And it goes out into the kidneys and the liver and like that. But if you just sort of focus on the core and the key areas, you even think about the key chakra areas and check in and ask yourself there, I find it gives you a lot of information and is not so hard to do. So that would be my simple answer. And Mandy, what else would you say?
I think that's great. And I'm actually kind of curious to hear from Brian, and I'm going to mute you. And Julia, I'll come to your question in a minute too. But Brian, can you just say a little bit more about what you're asking for here? I'm not sure I understand what it is you want to, what would represent a baby step to you?
Well, it was in reference to the comment that some folks will look like you, look at you blank when you ask them to, where's it in the body? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, that exercise you did with the arm, that's pretty relatable pretty much by almost any human. But talking to some guy who lives in his head or heads and nowhere else, it's going to sometimes be a little foreign. I have this concept myself that I do. I call joysticking. I've been practicing. So I have a mental joystick, and I imagine sensing all kinds of places throughout my body. But I'm new to this, and I'm on the upslope of being able to actually discern it.
Yeah.
But that's a little abstract and out there. So something like as a first step to get somebody going where they can start to get in touch with their neurobiology that otherwise is kind of foreign to them from a sensation perspective.
That's great. Yeah. So what I would say then in response to that, and that clarifies for me, Brian, thank you. What I would say is one of the things that I will do is just have someone track where their strongest sensation is. It doesn't work for somebody who's completely numb, but in my experience, few people are completely 100% numb. And so what I'll just ask people to, some people definitely are, and there's a question about this in the chat box that I want to get to. But what I will generally do is just ask people, like, scan your whole body and see if you can feel where is the strongest sensation now. And very commonly that will reveal something. And then I ask them to put their hand there, which is a way of bringing attention to it. One of the things that's very hard is because attention is a bit intangible, it takes a lot of practice to, and I'm gesturing up here as though attention only happens in your brain. That's not true at all. But we're very accustomed to having our attention way up here in our head. And it takes practice to drop attention into our viscera, into our bodies, into beneath our skin and below our neck, and like feel a sensation there, unless there's something that's really grabbing our attention. So I have people find the strongest sensation and then put their hand there. And then that can sometimes open a new conversation about, what is that sensation? What relationship might it have to what's going on here? So, Anne, you look like you might want to say something else in response to this.
I think that's great. And again, one of the things is a lot of the work with the body can make people feel very chaotic, can sort of make them feel a little out of control because I don't really know, and maybe I'm not very good at it, and it's not necessarily so confined in one thing. And so I also really love just giving people categories because it can be easier to ask specifically than in general, where do you feel it? But to say, what do you notice in your gut? Then they can like, okay, I can sort of lock in there, and that's a good baby step. And frankly, if all people ever did was say what they felt in their gut, it would be helpful. Be really helpful. But I like the categories of gut, heart, throat, because generally you're going to feel something there if there's stress or fear or something like that. So that's part of the managing the concrete sequential people who maybe have not been really rewarded for the wisdom of their body. Give them a category and it will be easier.
Agree. And that would be part of my answer to Chantal's question, right? Mm-hmm. When I ask people where people feel it in their body, like, what's that all about? What does it mean? How do you actually make sense of that? And what I find is following that core, following that center line, asking specific questions about specific areas, having people put their hand there as a way of helping to bring attention there. All of that helps. But then, you know, as you said, Anne, and I think this is so true, like if all people did was just feel sensations in their gut more actively, more attentively, it would completely revolutionize the world.
Change their life and probably change the world.
It would. And what? So one of the things that I think is possible, and Julia, I haven't missed your question, and
yeah,
I do
want to know that one too.
It's really important. But one of the things that I would say in terms of helping people make sense of what their sensations are meaning, this is back to that integration part, okay, right? This is back to what we were talking about, which is they've got a story about what's going on or an interpretation or a point of view or a belief system that is in some way associated with and maybe either congruent with or incongruent with whatever physical sensation is arising in their body, and helping them determine, like, does that sensation in my gut, does it go along with that story? And if I change my story, what do I need to change in the way I'm sitting or standing so that maybe my gut has room to feel something different? Right? So it's tying together their interpretation, their story, their narrative, their belief system, whatever they're doing in their conceptual understanding of the situation, and tying that together with whatever their physical experience is. It's that integration piece that will help people build relevance around, you know, why even look at the body in the first place.
Well, and there's something that we've been looking at Be Above that is, I don't know if you've seen this, and I can send it to you, Mandy. It's called the theory of constructed emotions. So it's sort of a different view of, and I think you would agree with this, that sort of the old view of like there are these core emotions and they are what they are and they have these neural signatures does not necessarily seem to be the case, and that emotions are more like fingerprints. So you can have an emotion that is as complicated as, a friend has a wonderful success, and you can have an emotion which is joy and jealousy and regret and sadness and elation and all of that fingerprint emotion for you. So I think part of the other thing I would add to making sense of it is, I love the part about what's the story you're telling? What's the story you want to tell? What do you want to construct with this? We have some choice there, and we also can sit with it and let it emerge and, you know, spend some time with it and kind of, you know, put in a placeholder. And one of my good friends is always telling me to sit with things longer, and said, well, part of what I have to do is I have to get the first layer off first. Let me just tell you what it looks like on the surface. Let me get the left brain out of the way and I'll tell you what it means. Then I'll sit with it and kind of keep it open. And I think there's that, especially in a coaching relationship, where it's, what else might it mean? And why don't you just sit with it this week and see what comes up? And what is your body trying to tell you maybe over time that isn't as apparent just right away on the surface?
Yeah, beautiful.
Oh. I think we're out of time, Mandy. How did that happen?
Well, I want, before we end, I do want to address this numbing question.
Yes, please.
Julia asked. Okay, so she asked, do you have a recommendation of somatic practice to help people get out of self-numbing? And I do have a great one for those of you who are interested in that. Google a YouTube video by Peter Levine with the word bellicon in it, bellicon. He talks about the use of a small trampoline as a way of gradually, slowly waking up sensation for people who are very numb to sensation. And he's specifically talking about trauma survivors, but we could use this practice for anyone. It's something that I really love. I'm a huge fan of, a huge believer in. And all of the things that I mentioned about, you know, rubbing your skin or tapping your body or getting your heart rate up or stretching, all of those things can wake up sensation. But when someone's in a pattern of self-numbing, it can really help to, you know, jump on this rebounder, which will get all your muscles, every muscle in the body moving, and then hold still for a minute and notice what sensations arise. And then jump again and hold still for a minute and notice what sensations arise. And it's sort of an unlock, a very gentle unlocking mechanism. So I recommend that.
Stacey found the video. Yay.
Thank you, Stacey. Yeah, it's a wonderful video. So thank you.
It's great. Crowdsourcing knowledge. I love.
Right. So we've got the video in the chat. If anyone's looking on the recording, we'll try and put that on the page as well. When we post the recording. And thank you all so much for joining us. This has been a blast.
Yeah, this is so fun, Mandy. Thank you for your just curiosity and openness and being such an awesome colleague. I really value having you in my life.
Likewise, likewise. And thank you all. I'm going to take everybody off mute so we can say goodbye to each other. Thanks, everybody.
Bye, Mandy.
So much.
Bye,
Anne.
Thank you. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. So good to see you.